Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer among men in the United States and the second leading cause of cancer deaths in men. It can usually be detected through a simple blood test, which is normally offered to all adult males of a certain age. That fact is one reason why former President Joe Biden's prostate cancer diagnosis was so shocking. He has an aggressive form which has already spread to his bones, which begs the question, why wasn't it detected before it spread? Early detection is key. Men who are diagnosed early before the cancer has spread survive for 5 years and beyond. The outlook is less favorable for those who don't catch it early. Testing is simple and treatments are available. And this hour, we will look at prostate cancer, the treatments available, and promising new treatments just coming online or maybe in the pipeline that minimize negative side effects. Dr. Andrew Armstrong is a medical oncologist and professor in the Department of Medicine at the Duke University School of Medicine. Dr. Catherine Gessner is an assistant professor of urology and a urologic oncologist at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And Bob Lane is a prostate cancer survivor. They're all with us. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning, Mike.
Good. You have to speak. It's radio. That's how they know you're here. Dr. Armstrong, let me start with you and with President Biden's diagnosis. Given the elite medical care that presidents receive while in office, does it surprise you his recent diagnosis? He's only been out of office 5 months. He's diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer that has already spread to his bones. Should we be surprised by that?
Well, Mike, I think as a medical oncologist, I see a number of patients who, despite great health care, develop metastatic disease because of its aggressive nature. These types of cancers can spread quickly, and that's why we have early detection and screening programs. I don't know all of the details of how he was being screened, but generally the U.S. Preventative Task Force has recommended that we stop screening in a patient in their 70 to 75 range, but generally we recommend patients stop screening when they are anticipated to have less than 10 years life expectancy. And so, you know, you could argue that, you know, presidents should probably be screened for many healthcare conditions. And I don't know the details. It's possible that his cancer didn't make a lot of PSA. It was detected by a rectal exam. And I have many patients where their cancer had a low PSA and was aggressive. So I don't know the details. I'm glad at least they did pick it up. I don't know when it could have developed, but prostate cancer can develop over a short time and sometimes a long time. So there's really different types of prostate cancer out there.
And Bob, I read, this could be incorrect, but I read that the president's diagnosis was close to the diagnosis you received, and that kind of elicited a strong reaction in you. If that's accurate, how so?
Yes, Mike, that is accurate. And to piggyback on what Dr. Armstrong just said, my cancer was actually found almost by mistake by my general practitioner. He was treating me for diverticulitis, ran some tests, said, by the way, your PSA is 7.5, and it's probably a mistake because 4 months ago in your annual physical, it was 1.3. But go get it checked. So I got it checked, and 2 weeks after that, it was 10.5. So to basically support what Dr. Armstrong just said, mine was racing like a racehorse. It was just fortuitous that I happened to have diverticulitis and then my GP happened to check for it. So yeah, it's the same thing. Mine later in years metastasized into my bones and I dealt with it that way. But yes, a very eerily similar, real aggressive diagnosis at the first pitch.
Dr. Gessner, the word screening has been used in this conversation, and I take it that the way that urologists and others, primary care physicians, screen for this is that PSA test, which is a blood test, and the rectal exam. Are there other ways?
Those are the primary ways that we screen for prostate cancer. The American Urological Association recommend that men between 50 and 69 undergo screening or at least have a discussion with their physician about screening. Based off of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force that Dr. Armstrong mentioned, this really should be a shared decision-making between a patient and their provider in terms of, life expectancy, goals of care, and whether they undergo screening. And so we typically do a PSA to start. If it's elevated, we typically recommend a repeat one. If that's their first diagnosis of elevated PSA, we know that many other causes, such as urinary tract infections or other inflammatory states of the prostate, can cause an elevated PSA. And so we typically repeat it, as well as do a digital rectal exam, as you mentioned.
When do these screenings begin? At what age?
We typically start having the discussion with men around 50. However, if they have certain risk factors, including men with a family history, known genetic mutations, or Black men, we typically start closer to 40 or 45, about having that discussion of, should we start screening?
And the reason you do it more often or sooner with Black men is because they seem to have a more prevalence of the disease than white men and other nationalities, other races. Is that correct?
Right, they're at a higher risk, and also can get more aggressive disease.
I think the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has recommended that men over 75 not be screened. And that could be why President Biden was recently diagnosed, because they stopped screening. He's older than that. Why did we stop?
The benefit of treatment at that point reduces, and so we know that as men get older, they're at a higher risk of getting prostate cancer. But a lot of those prostate cancers can be low risk and may never cause any problems or any symptoms, or they will be more incidentally found, and then treating those can cause more harm than benefit in the long term for those patients.
And Dr. Armstrong, I take it that prostate cancer is it's ubiquitous. I mean, I have read, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that almost all men will get it. Most will die with it and not of it. Is that accurate?
That is completely accurate. It does increase with age. Age is one of the biggest risk factors, as well as being screened for it. But the lethal component of prostate cancer also increases with age. So simply because we stop checking for it doesn't mean it goes away. And we certainly saw that post-COVID with about a 20% uptick in the rate of metastatic diagnoses because men weren't getting screened. And we see this in other parts of the world where there's no early detection programs or screening at all. About 50 to 70% of all men will have metastatic disease who have prostate cancer. And in the United States, fortunately, we do screening, and only about 5 or 10% of men with prostate cancer have metastatic disease. So having metastatic disease is an outlier. It's not common. It can be prevented and detected early, but not in all men. For this reason, prostate cancer is the number one survived cancer among men in our country. So only about 6 out of 7 men are cured, but 1 out of 7 will develop a relapse and ultimately suffer from more aggressive disease.
You talked about the, you were the first person on this panel to talk about the PSA test. That is the prostate-specific antigen screening test. It's a simple blood test that they look for those antigens, I guess, and they calculate the amount that you have. The higher the number, the better prospect you have for having prostate cancer. But I'm told that this is not a perfect tool for detecting prostate cancer. Why not?
That's exactly right. It's prostate specific, not prostate cancer specific. So you can have benign causes cause elevation, and you can have aggressive cancers not produce a lot of PSA. I've had some patients call it prostate specific anxiety because they're very worried about their PSA levels, and it's not necessarily, an indicator of their aggressiveness of their disease. So PSA is a useful test. There's a lot more fancy forms of PSA, different prostate health indices and isoforms of PSA that many urologists will get, free PSAs, different calculations that can help them decide, along with a MRI of the prostate, who to biopsy and who can be left alone.
In a report by NPR on the last couple of years, Dr. Brent Rose, who is a radiation oncologist and associate professor at the University of California, San Diego, says PSA testing leaves a lot to be desired as a cancer screening test. And although beneficial, he says there are risks. And so it is a personal decision whether or not to do PSA screening. First of all, do you agree with that statement? What are the risks? And it's a simple blood test. So why would you say no?
Yes, it's mostly about the downstream consequences of what you do with the test. And, you know, the PSA is a simple blood test. It can be started in the early to mid 40s in high-risk men, 50 in average-risk men. And that midlife PSA can really decide what your risks are in the future. It's kind of like getting your first colonoscopy. And if you have no polyps at all, you might skip 10 years. And if you have a couple polyps, then you're at high risk. Having an elevated PSA early puts you at higher risk of cancer later, and you might end up being more aggressive with surveillance in that patient. The harms of PSA screening tend to be the downstream consequences. Radical prostatectomy, radiation, hormones can cause treatment side effects, impotence, incontinence. We have the harms of the biopsy itself, which can cause infections, anxiety, the patient's facing a cancer diagnosis that they might have otherwise avoided. But it is a proven life-saving measure in population studies and randomized trials. People have shown a reduction in the risk of dying of prostate cancer. So there's trade-offs when you make that informed decision.
Dr. Gessner.
Yeah, I completely agree with what Dr. Armstrong said about the risks of PSA screening. I think over time, we've become more nuanced in what we do with the results of that test downstream. And I think that has helped reduce some of the harms of PSA screening. And so we know that normal, one example of that is that a normal prostate can makes PSA as well. And so just simply having an enlarged prostate can elevate your PSA. And so we use tools like prostate MRI, like Dr. Armstrong mentioned, and PSA density, where we normalize for the size of the prostate to reduce the number of patients that are undergoing a biopsy and reduce the downstream harm of that test.
So your PSA level can stay at the same level for a long time. It can also gradually increase over a long period of time, which could be a signal that something might be going wrong. In your case, Bob, your elevated PSA happened almost overnight. It went, as you said, from a 1 to a 7 in a matter of months, and that was a clear indicator to your physician that something else was going on. What happened next after they decided you have a potential problem here? What happened next?
Well, Mike, the next step for me was a biopsy. They took 12 core samples out of the prostate. And then found that actually all 12 of them were loaded with cancer. So it was pretty easy decision that it was growing quickly, and it was through all, 12 different sectors of the prostate that it should come out. And that was, I did run a second opinion, and they agreed with that completely. So it was taken out actually in just under 30 days. Which is a little bit faster than normal after a biopsy because of the inflammation that stays with the prostate. But they went ahead and did it.
Prior to the show, we were talking about the way doctors have traditionally checked for this, and it's a combination of that PSA blood test and a digital rectal exam. Anybody over the age of 40 probably has experienced that. It is uncomfortable, or it's people think it's uncomfortable, but it's momentary. But when we talk about a biopsy, that must get a little much more uncomfortable. We'll talk about that when we come back. I don't want to scare people away from this, but it's something that I guess we should talk about, how they do this biopsy. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the most prevalent form of cancer in men and the second leading cause of cancer deaths in men, and that would be prostate cancer. Dr. Andrew Armstrong is with us. He is a medical oncologist and professor of medicine at the Duke University School of Medicine. Dr. Catherine Gessner is a urological oncologist and an assistant professor of urology at UNC Chapel Hill. And Bob Lane is a prostate cancer survivor who now sits at his urologist's office twice a week and offers advice and help to other men who have been recently diagnosed. And we'll talk about why he does that a little while from now. But you mentioned that after your diagnosis, or after they discovered, Bob, highly elevated and quickly elevated levels of PSA antigens in your bloodstream, they decided it was time to do a biopsy. First of all, who does that? Which doctor does that? And what does it involve? And be careful how you describe this.
Well, my urologist did it, it's involved in basically getting a local anesthetic applied to the anus, and then a tool is inserted by the doctor, and 12 very, very small needles will go into the prostate quickly in and then back out, and withdrawing core samples for the doctors to test. But to see if there is any cancerous cell activity in there. So does it hurt? No, it doesn't hurt. It didn't hurt me, and it doesn't hurt most men. Is it uncomfortable? It sure is. Does it last very long? No, it was under a minute. So it didn't take very long at all. Prep took a little, probably longer than the actual event. And it was, bam, 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 12 shots. So it's probably all told about a minute. At least it seemed that way to me. It didn't seem very long at all, and not painful at all. So a little bit uncomfortable, a little bit weird.
Yeah. Bob went in with symptoms of something completely unrelated to prostate cancer and found that through a course of a blood test that he had a highly elevated PSA. You would not have is it accurate to say, Bob, that you would not have discovered this cancer had you not gone in for another series of symptoms that were unrelated?
I don't believe I would have been diagnosed, at least not at the early stage, because I had no symptoms whatsoever.
Are there symptoms, Dr. Gessner? I mean, for in normal situations, if you have already had this and it's in an advanced stage, or I guess the better question is, at what stage does this begin to present symptoms?
I think this is a really important point, Mike, and I really appreciate you asking. In its early stages, when it is most treatable, prostate cancer typically has no symptoms, which is why having that discussion with your physician about screening and whether that's appropriate for you is really important. I have a lot of patients who say, well, before they've gotten a biopsy, they say, well, I don't have any symptoms, so everything's probably okay. But in its early stages, patients typically don't have symptoms. Now, as prostate cancer progresses to a more either locally advanced disease or metastatic disease where it has spread outside the prostate, patients can definitely develop symptoms. Those later stages are more difficult to treat. But if it's locally advanced disease, men can have trouble peeing. They can have blood in their urine. They can have painful ejaculation. They can kind of when it becomes more metastatic, you can get fatigue, bone pain, more systemic symptoms.
The biopsy that Bob talked about, Dr. Gessner, seems to be relatively invasive. Even if it only takes a minute or so, it's still invasive and probably scary to a lot of men and certainly uncomfortable. But what other means, aside from that, the PSA test, the digital rectal exam, which is also uncomfortable for a lot of people, what other ways do you have at your disposal to alert you to a problem?
Right. So we typically use the PSA screening test and the digital rectal exam to kind of identify the problem at first. Once that's identified, we've started using more prostate MRI. That is a test that is performed at kind of, I think, nationwide now, where It allows us to see, are there any lesions in the prostate that are suspicious for high risk or what we call clinically significant prostate cancer, where it's at a higher grade and may cause problems. So we're trying to not identify those really low risk cases, but identify a more clinically significant disease. And that prostate MRI allows us to further risk stratify who should undergo a biopsy and who shouldn't. The biopsy is definitely, anxiety provoking. It can be uncomfortable, and it also has harms associated with it or risks associated with it. And so we've become more nuanced in who undergoes a biopsy.
Dr. Armstrong, I said that prostate cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among men. Do we understand why?
The risk factors, Mike, for prostate cancer certainly is age, but it's also one of the more inherited forms of cancer. Germline or hereditary cancer testing is recommended among men with more aggressive forms of prostate cancer, and we're slowly moving towards more of a universal testing because there's so many hereditary alterations that you can get from your mom or dad and pass on to your children that could convey cancer risk, not just prostate cancer, but in women, breast and ovarian cancer. And so it's really important to take a good family history, to understand your family history as you're trying to decide what your own personal cancer risks may be, not just prostate cancer. And so hereditary components are important. Lifestyle is about half important as well. So things like obesity, being overweight, sedentary lifestyles, being tall, not something you can modify, but unfortunately.
Why would that be a factor, being
Well,
tall?
there. Having greater body mass, being tall, may be associated with altered growth hormone levels, insulin growth factor, things like that have been established to be epidemiologically associated. Now, the modifiable risk factors in terms of diet and lifestyle may be related to, processed foods, avoiding being overweight, a healthy lifestyle, eating cruciferous vegetables, tomato intake, a number of epidemiologic studies. Now, that doesn't mean in randomized controlled studies we've proven that there is a preventative strategy. It's just these are associations. And so these are generally things that, like avoiding smoking, maintaining a healthy body mass, these are going to be helpful for dozens of cancers as well as heart disease. So things that generally primary care doctors should be recommending and patients doing anyway, but a nice side effect is a lower risk of prostate cancer.
Go back to tomato intake. Is that good or bad for you?
Tomato intake has been shown to be protective. Lycopene is what makes tomatoes and watermelons red and has been associated with reduced prostate cancer. That doesn't mean that when you get prostate cancer, you can start doing a lot of those things, but it doesn't hurt. It could help. It could reduce the burden of prostate cancer. It can certainly lead to a healthy lifestyle, and a more heart-healthy diet is also generally felt to be good for your prostate as well.
So of these factors, hereditary factors, if your father, your uncle, your brother has had prostate cancer, you may have a greater chance of getting it. Hereditary factors, environmental factors, lifestyle factors, what you eat, do you smoke, it's how much do you drink, etc. Of those factors, which seem to be, or do you know the answer to this, which seem to be the most troublesome?
Well, it's really a tie. Certainly there are genes that increase the risk of really aggressive prostate cancer, like the BRCA2 gene. And then there's some exposures, like tobacco smoke, certain military exposures that have increased the risk of really aggressive prostate cancers. So, environment and genetics are really equally converging or conspiring to cause some forms of aggressive prostate cancer.
Bob.
Dr. Armstrong just mentioned the military aspect of it. One out of eight general men in this country will contract it. One out of six black men and one out of five veterans. So
Yeah.
it's good.
Is that because of something they're exposed to while in the military? I know that Agent Orange perhaps is a risk factor exposure to that. Is that why?
That's part of it. That and tar pits and things like that is what they suspect. I believe either you doctors would know more about it than I
Yeah,
would.
there's certainly a number of exposures, certainly back to the Vietnam War, Agent Orange was associated with a range of cancers. But the kind of modern Agent Orange might be more these burn pits, exposures to smoke from whatever was being burned in the Gulf Wars or Afghanistan or Bosnia. And I see a number of veterans who have linked their cancer at a young age without hereditary components to military exposure. Some of this could be water at the military bases. Some of this could be exposure to radiation. Some of it could be smoking, lifestyle. So a lot of normal things happen to veterans too, age. So it's hard to sometimes pinpoint exactly a single cause.
Dr. Gessner, a lot of doctors, when they see rising PSA levels, will take a wait-and-see attitude, perhaps even if, I guess I should ask the question. They take a wait-and-see attitude because they don't want to do anything dramatic just based on a PSA test. At what point does the wait-and-see give way to we have to do something?
I think that's an individual, it requires an individualized approach, really. I don't think there's a specific number that you can say, hey, at this point, we're going to do something. But certainly getting a prostate MRI and then proceeding with a biopsy based off of whether the patient, essentially wants to through shared decision making or they have other risk factors. I think you have to take the entire patient, their goals of care, their other medical conditions, and their specific risk factors into play.
Both Bob and Dr. Armstrong want to chime in here. Dr. Armstrong, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I agree with Kate. It is very personalized. You should realize that as young men, their PSAs are naturally low because they don't have a big prostate. Older men, their prostates grow. So there's actually PSA growth curves that we have to kind of get what the normal is based on age. So a young guy's PSA in their 40s might typically be lower than 1.5, but an older patient in their 70s, normal PSA might be up to 6.5 just because of that big prostate. And so 3.0 is kind of what we use in across the state for primary care to trigger a bigger workup. That doesn't mean you have prostate cancer if your PSA is 3. As Kate mentioned, we simply repeat it, and about 20% of the time, the PSA just goes right back down. But so there's a lot of individualization based on age, life expectancy, and preferences there.
Bob?
A couple of things, too. Generally speaking, what I understand, again, I'm not, like, never been to medical school, but from my experience and research, that if a PSA will double in 6 months or less, typically that would maybe give a doctor a reason to think that maybe something's up. And then watch it again 3 months later. Is how close is it doubling again? That might be an indication that there's something wrong there.
I mentioned that most men will die with this disease, not of it. And autopsies have found prostate cancer is so widespread that more than one third of white men and half of black men in their 70s had cancers that would never have harmed them, prostate cancers. Because I suppose it has stayed within the prostate. It has not escaped the capsule. It has not metastasized. If you are diagnosed, Dr. Gessner, with prostate cancer, what are the dangers? How do you determine the dangers and whether or to sit there and not do anything or do something because you're afraid that it might metastasize?
That's an excellent question, Mike. We typically utilize a variety of factors to risk stratify each patient's prostate cancer. And so when we perform the biopsy, which is really the only way to officially diagnose prostate cancer, either a biopsy of a metastatic site or a tissue diagnosis from the prostate, the pathologist looks at it under the microscope and they look at each prostate sample. In Bob's case, it was 12, and that's a pretty standard for a systematic biopsy. They look at it under the microscope, and in each core that they see prostate cancer, they give it a score, and that's called the Gleason grade. And it goes from 3 to 4 to 5, with 3 being the least aggressive and 5 being the most aggressive. And in each core, they give it 2 grade scores, and then you can add them together to get the formal Gleason grade. So then, if it's 3+3, which is the lowest risk prostate cancer, that's a 6. Highest risk would be a 10. And we use that Gleason grade, the number of cores that are positive, the PSA, and any staging imaging that we can get to.
Can you tell from the Gleason score how aggressive this cancer might be, or the kind of cancer that it is, the likelihood that it will escape and metastasize? Can you tell?
Yes. Yeah. So Gleason 6 is considered to be low risk and unlikely to spread outside the prostate. For low risk prostate cancer, we typically, our AUA guidelines recommend active surveillance for that, where we don't intervene at that moment, but we closely monitor the prostate cancer for signs of it becoming more aggressive. And of course, a Gleason 10, which is the most aggressive form, that would be a very high risk prostate cancer that we're going to act quickly to treat.
So, Dr. Armstrong, is this a sliding scale, a step by step, or does is the difference between a Gleason 6, which he describes as relatively safe, and a Gleason 7, which is one step up, but it's between 6 and 10, and 10's the worst, is it a difference of magnitude, or is it simply one step up the scale?
It's complicated. These Gleason scores were invented over 50 years ago, and we're getting into more complex technology, digital pathology, AI stratified tools to really make more informed decisions and personalized decisions. But in general, with each point up, there's an increased risk of relapse and mortality, whether you choose surgery, radiation, or surveillance. And we're making personalized decisions, such as combined radiation and hormones for patients with more aggressive forms of prostate cancer, intermediate and high-risk patients. And we're really trying to leave patients alone if they, have really low-risk disease because we value their survivorship and don't want to cause side effects.
Do you remember your Gleason score, Bob?
Oh yeah. It was an aggressive eight.
Wow. Surprising to you, scary to you. What was your reaction to that?
I cried like a baby when I learned about that. And very once I knew what I was getting into, or what was getting into me, it was very very concerning. But the team, the staff, walked me off the cliff, so to speak, and talked to me about if it were early enough in the stage. That it was, 90%+ chance of having a long life. So they told me I'd get more likely to hit by a bus walking out of the office than I would be to die of prostate cancer.
Once you've been through all these different tests and doctors have been monitoring where you stand with your PSA score, your Gleason score, they've perhaps done a biopsy, et cetera, and you know what that is, then you have to decide on a treatment. And we're going to talk about what treatments are available, what treatments are in the pipeline, and what they mean once you've had them when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about prostate cancer in men, the most common form of cancer in men, with two oncologists. Dr. Andrew Armstrong is a medical oncologist and professor of medicine at Duke University School of Medicine. Dr. Catherine Gessner is an assistant professor of urology and a urologic oncologist at UNC Chapel Hill. And Bob Lane is a prostate cancer survivor. Once you've been diagnosed, once you have, your Gleason score through these tests, Dr. Armstrong, you have to make a decision. You and your doctor have to make a decision about what course of action to take. What courses of action are available?
Well, Mike, I'd probably start with saying this is a journey, and getting second opinions can be helpful. At Duke, we have a multidisciplinary clinic where patients come from all over the state and region to hear from urologists like Kate, medical oncologists like me, radiation oncologists, to hear about the many ways of treating prostate cancer. And for individual patients, there's never necessarily always the best way. There's different ways, different menus on the table based on their own personal preferences about side effects, what their individual risk is. Sometimes it takes what we call a multidisciplinary approach, where men might need surgery followed by radiation, or radiation plus hormones, where different team members are going to be part of your team. And I think going through that journey, getting informed decisions, hearing all that information first before making that decision is really important.
And if you choose radiation, I'm told that may preclude some other treatments down the road. Is that accurate? I'm not sure what I'm
Well,
talking about here,
it's
so help
important to
me.
realize that surgery and radiation can equally cure prostate cancer. All right, so sometimes it takes a little bit of hormonal therapy or blocking of testosterone, that male hormone, with radiation to result in similar cure rates as, what a urologist can do with what's called a radical prostatectomy. But yes, I mean, we don't often do surgery after radiation because there's a lot of scar tissue and there can be a very morbid procedure, but it's also because when cancer comes back after radiation, it's usually because it's spread beyond the prostate. Same with, after a prostatectomy. It usually either can spread locally or it can be in the pelvis or in more distant sites. And we use kind of fancy PET imaging to identify these now, either up front or at recurrence.
So that decision, whether to have radiation treatment or whether to have a radical prostatectomy or some other treatment, seems to be a relatively important decision for what happens down the road. How to best make that decision?
Well, that decision is made in consultation with a team of specialists and, with your loved ones and hearing about those risks up front. For example, the side effects usually will make that decision for patients.
And
A
what are
patient
they?
who's on the younger side tends to pick surgery. A patient who's on the older side tends to pick radiation, and that's simply because surgery in an older patient has more surgical risks, anesthesia, blood loss. In a patient who's younger, radiation can cause secondary cancers, and they may have a longer life expectancy where that secondary cancer may be a bigger deal than their first cancer, the prostate cancer, to cure. So there's a lot of individualization there.
Dr. Gessner.
Yeah, I completely agree with what Dr. Armstrong said here, and I think it's a really important takeaway that treatment of prostate cancer likely involves a team approach. Where you meet with both a urologic oncologist and radiation oncologist, sometimes a medical oncologist, to talk about the side effects of each treatment choice and your individual goals of care and how your goals align best with those two treatment options.
And what are the side effects of radiation treatment?
Yeah, so the side effects of radiation treatment, as Dr. Armstrong mentioned, you can get long term, you can get secondary malignancies. So cancers that arise within the radiation field, you can get erectile dysfunction, and then you can get some worsening of urinary side effects as well.
Bob, you had a radical prostatectomy where they go in and they do surgery and they remove the prostate. Was that an option that you chose, or was that what they said you had to have done, given the stage of your cancer and the fact that it had metastasized?
Well, they didn't know it had metastasized at that point.
Okay.
But given the aggressive nature of it, I mean, we talked about doubling in 6 months. Mine grew eightfold in 4 months. So they knew it was very aggressive. So it was in 12 out of 12 with the core samples. So it really wasn't too many. There wasn't much of an option. But before I get further down that road, as Dr. Armstrong said, the success rates are very, very similar for radiation and surgery. So it is a choice, definitely for men and their loved ones to make.
Dr. Armstrong.
Yeah, I'd like to point out, like Bob said, the treatments are equally curative, but they're also getting better over time. Our radiation approaches are getting more precise, where a higher dose is able to be delivered in more safe ways. Our hormonal treatments are getting better. So even patients with stage four metastatic disease are living many more years longer than they used to. And we're curing more men, in the early disease, but aggressive disease setting with different cocktails of hormones. Surgery is even getting better. The comorbidities related to surgery, maybe Kate could talk a little bit about that.
Okay,
Yeah,
go.
thank you. Absolutely. We historically performed radical prostatectomies as an open procedure. And as Dr. Armstrong mentioned, we're becoming more precise. We're using the robot most of the time for these surgeries now. And that allows us to do what's called a nerve-sparing prostatectomy, where we spare the nerves that control erections. And additionally, in addition to surgery becoming more precise, we're also developing more what are called focal therapies, where they're not officially in our guidelines yet, but high intensity focused ultrasound is an example of a less invasive approach that we can treat prostate cancer in a more kind of nuanced, localized manner that with fewer side effects.
Bob.
You want to follow up? You asked earlier, Mike, about why metastasis and et cetera. It didn't actually, once the prostatectomy took place, I was negligible, zero, for over 3 years. I was checking every 90 days. And then it came back very, very slowly. For 4 years, we watched it grow slowly because the technology for knowing where it was back then is nowhere near as good as the technology for knowing that it was in there somewhere. And finally, it took off again like a rocket, which allowed them to find it. And it was in the bone, similar to what the former President Biden. It was sensitive, which was good to know, meaning it was going to be treatable with hormones. But first, it took radiation. It was up in C1 vertebrae between my brain and my spinal cord. So it got way out of the cavity and sat up there and for 3 years and then decided to go off. You know, so it runs the gamut, and it really requires a constant checking and surveillance, even after the prostatectomy, I guess is the point I was trying to make.
So you had your prostate removed, your PSA level fell. Then several years later, it came back and began to rise. It spiked in 2021, I understand, and that was an indication that it had spread to where you said it spread. But now you are cancer-free. Is that correct?
Yes. I'm cancer-free for coming on 4 years.
What is, so 5 years is a good sign, right?
Yes. Yeah. So is six.
So the initial diagnosis and decision had to have been traumatic. What was it like for you when it came back?
The first thought through my mind was that it's never good when cancer comes back. I've always heard stories of people who beat cancer and then it came back and then they're gone. So again, the staff walked me off that ledge and said, hey, you know, we've gotten this early enough that this is a treatable cancer. It's not your standard type of cancer that when it comes back, it's more prone to take you out.
Men don't like doctors. Men avoid doctors. That's the common wisdom at the moment. It may not be true, but it seems to be true. And men don't like to talk about things like this. It makes them very uncomfortable. And I would think that the first thing you want to do when you're given a diagnosis like this is to talk to somebody, or at least to be able to read the experience of other people who have gone through what you are about to endure. Bob, did you find sources for that information? Or I'm going to guess that the answer is no, which is why you sit outside an elevator at your urologist's office and help people.
I actually did have a source who spent a half hour or an hour with me, and he went over a list of questions and answers and possible side effects. So he gave me a heads up as to what I might expect at the earliest stages. But it is why I sit out by the elevator, because our head nurse there at the urology specialist asked me one day, she said, and we knew each other for 4 or 5 years at this point. She said, don't you think it'd be nice if men had somebody to talk to? I said, yeah, it'd be great. And she waited 10, 15 seconds and asked me again. And I said, you're not asking my opinion, I don't think. So ever since then, I've been sitting out there, and I don't approach patients because it's a pretty sacred space. Having been there, I know. But we come up with different gimmicks to get people to actually ask me what I'm doing out there. And once they do that, then the conversation can begin.
Have you found that there are sufficient online resources, chat groups, or whatever you call them, places to go on the internet where you can get accurate information from people who have experienced this, or is that rare?
No, it's very common. There are support groups. There are dozens, if not hundreds, probably hundreds, maybe thousands, and they are easily. It's easy to find them. And I do share that information. I have three different sources of them, all credible. My goal when I meet with patients is to keep them off the internet. And I will give them information from the Mayo Clinic, from the Cleveland Clinic, from Prostate Cancer Foundation, American Cancer Society, and show them. And I never give them a recommendation. I'm not a doctor. I said earlier, I've never been to med school. I never took biology. But I do try and give them information to help them make decisions and questions to ask their doctors.
We have an email from a listener who prefers to remain anonymous, Bob, and he or she, I guess it's a he says, "I met Bob in the hall outside my urologist's office and had a long chat with him. While my cancer is not aggressive and completely manageable, Gleason score 6, it was nice to have Bob as a resource. The biopsy was painless, but because only a local anesthetic is used, you are cognizant of the elements of the procedure. The sound of each of the 12 tissue samples taken is painless, but the sound of it is disconcerting. It sounds like a stapler. As for anxiety," he says, "I have an arrangement with my urologist that he will worry about it until I need to. My urologist actively monitors my cancer, mostly with regular PSA tests twice a year, but I also had a second biopsy on the 5th anniversary of the diagnosis." Is that an uncommon story, Bob, from your experience?
No, it's not uncommon at all. I think it the and I thank you, whoever you are. I'm glad you appreciated the time. The commonality of the subsequent biopsies, I can't speak to that because I don't know enough about that. So I'll defer to the doctors on the call here.
Medical science is making advances, and hopefully they will continue on almost every front, particularly in the field of cancer, relatively rapidly all of a sudden. And Dr. Armstrong, I know that you were involved in a study of a treatment using a combination, I'm going to mispronounce this, of enzalutamide with androgen deprivation therapy. You say it correctly for me.
Enzalutamide.
Okay, I was close. Which proved to significantly increase the chance of a 5-year survival rate for men with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. Talk about that.
Sure, that was called the ARCHES study, Mike, and the ARCHES trial was over 1,000 men globally. It tested an old form of kind of weaker hormonal therapies, drugs like leuprolide, and it combined with a more potent form, that's the enzalutamide, in a randomized sense. And in 2019, this trial was positive, and it led to the FDA approval of this drug for men who have metastatic, what we call hormone-sensitive disease. What we'll be presenting in Chicago next week is the 5-year update, so giving long-term survival results showing that, on average, men are living more than 3 years longer than they used to, that they're making these important milestones going out 5 years, better chance of being alive. So, we were starting the talk about Joe Biden and his cancer. His cancer presumably is hormone sensitive, as most patients are in the beginning. About 99% remain that way. And the good news is we can control cancer a lot longer and a lot better with these very precise targeting strategies.
That study led to an FDA-approved drug, and it was partially funded through federal funds. I'm curious how much of that federal funding led to this and what your fear is about these recent decisions on the part of the Trump administration to cut back federal funding.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. A lot of these drugs are discovered by basic scientists. In this case, enzalutamide used to be called MDV-3100. It was discovered by a chemist and a basic scientist, Charles Sawyers, at UCLA. And using NIH funding, they did a drug screen and found it was quite miraculous in the lab. And early publications led to great excitement and eventual investment and companies formed around it. And that's happening now with new drugs. And we do worry about reductions in cancer research funding so that, 10, 20 years from now, we might see a reduction in that pace of discovery. We want to keep that pace of discovery going.
I only have about a minute left here, Bob. I know that getting the diagnosis is scary and troubling and an emotional roller coaster for both you and in many cases, spouses who are involved in all of this. You had a radical prostatectomy. What was the recovery like for you? What has that emotional roller coaster been like?
Not all that arduous. I mean, mentally, the only mental issue for me is thinking about it in the years earlier, thinking about it and dreading the 90-day checkup. What's it going to reveal? What's it going to reveal? But I'm 11 years in, and I frankly have stopped thinking about that until I know it pops up on my calendar. So it's not a concern, and I don't worry to heck and back once the blood draw has been taken, waiting for the results. I figure, okay, it's going to be what it's going to be, and even if it goes up, we have new methodologies and new drugs, et cetera, to treat it. So it's, I don't want to say it's a non-event, but it's certainly not a life event.
I wish we had time to talk about things that might be in the pipeline that offer better options for treatment or better options for early detection, but we are completely out of time. Bob Lane is a prostate cancer survivor. Elevator Bob. Dr. Catherine Gessner is assistant professor of urology at UNC Chapel Hill, and Dr. Andrew Armstrong is a medical oncologist and professor of medicine at Duke University School of Medicine. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.